state in the matter of the welfare of the children of JKT, JKLS parents?
Council, as you probably are aware, the rules for our, governing our proceedings are the same here on Zoom.gov as they are in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask you each time you begin your argument to introduce yourself, because we are recording these and the audio recordings will be posted on our website. If you encounter any technical difficulties, which hasn't been happening recently, but you never know, let us know, because we will try and assist you in taking care of them. We do want to hear everything you have to say this morning. So with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, and may it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Mallory Stoll, and in this appeal, I represent the mother, JKT, in these proceedings. I may refer to her by her initials or alternatively as mother. JKT is before the court requesting that the Court of Appeals reverse the termination of her parental rights as to her three oldest children. The bases that are contained in appellant's brief are focused on the lack of reasonable efforts, as well as the county's failure to prove by clear and convincing evidence that there was a ground for termination in this case. Given that we have a short amount of time this morning to discuss this case, I am going to focus primarily on the issue as it relates to reasonable efforts, but of course I welcome the court's questions as to the grounds for termination as well. Your Honors, when we look at reasonable efforts in a termination of parental rights case, we look at not only the efforts that were made to prevent the out-of-home placement, but also the efforts made to reunify the children with their custodial parent at the earliest possible time. These efforts are required in every case when we are dealing with the termination of parental rights, unless the court makes an explicit finding otherwise, using the procedures that are contained within. Yes, Judge Larkin.
Please finish your sentence. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to alert you to a question when you get to a breaking point.
Yes, thank you. I was just simply going to conclude that in this case, the court did not make a finding that would have, relieved the social services agency of providing reasonable efforts. So they were absolutely required in this case, contrary to one of the arguments asserted in respondent's brief.
My question for you, to the extent you're challenging a reasonable efforts determination, is what efforts were lacking? What other services should have been provided to enable reunification?
Judge Larkin, I'm going to break that down into two ways, and then I will expand upon those as time allows. The county's efforts, from JKT's perspective, first and foremost, were wholly lacking with regard to visitation between the children and JKT. I do think, given that we have three children in this case, the youngest child was arguably somewhat situated differently compared to the two older children, but that to me is the most flagrant violation of the reasonable efforts that were required in this case. The second component of that is related to the fact that when we look at those six factors to determine if reasonable efforts were made to reunify, there are concerns that those efforts were not timely, were not relevant, were not consistent, so that JKT could in fact demonstrate that she had corrected the conditions that led to the out-of-home placement.
Let me stop you there. Could you first tell us, as to visitation, it's my understanding that visitation was restricted based on mother's behavior during visits, which on one occasion led to the police being called to remove her from a visit. Is that accurate? And if so, what direction should the district court have gone with visitation given those circumstances?
Judge Larkin, the record does contain that finding. I would acknowledge that. However, we need to look at the record as a whole and what led to the court making that finding. The court made that finding in February 2021 in response to the respondent's request to suspend contact. Before then, JKT had had, I believe, two visits with the youngest child that were part of the parental capacity evaluation and the attachment assessment that were completed by those witnesses. Before that, the youngest child had not had any in-person contact with his mother for months. So when we bring that full circle to what was going on in February of 2021, the finding was made based largely on not only stale information that preceded mother's entry into Welcome Manor, which I think is a critical component of this case when we assess whether it was reasonable to deny visitation, but to go a step further, it's difficult to see how those assessments, quite frankly, would have ever been favorable given the circumstances that the county effectively created by significantly restricting that visitation. Judge Jessen?
So I just want to follow up on Judge Larkin's question. So you would agree that really from our, would you agree that from our standard review, the question has been whether that February 4th, 2021, those factual findings in that court order were clearly erroneous. Is that, I mean, isn't that the approach we should be looking at? And if you agree with that, then tell me which ones, what's clearly erroneous?
Judge Jessen, I don't necessarily agree that that is the proper focus in this case. First, when we look at reasonable efforts, we need to look throughout the duration of the case.
What you're saying, let me just make sure I understand you, is okay, we need to look at reasonable efforts first as far as visitation, and I understand you're also questioning some other reasonable efforts or lack thereof. So as far as visitation goes, was the supervised visitation until February 4th, was that appropriate? Were those efforts reasonable?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's one question we have before us, right?
And yes.
But as far as the limits on visitation after February 4th, that's what my question is. On those, as far as those limitations, aren't we really looking to see whether the district court's factual findings are clearly erroneous? So maybe you could take it in two parts?
Yes, I think that would make the most sense, Judge Jessen. So let's start with the efforts before February 4th of 2021. JKT had 7 in-person visits with her young child who was at a critical stage of his development over the course of from February 2020 until the assessments in December of 2021. Again, when we look at the visitation plans and what are required as a part of reasonable efforts, 260C.178 subdivision 3 requires that the social services agency include that the agency has the duty to develop and implement a plan for parental visitation of and contact with the child that promotes the parent and child relationship. Now, the record is what it is. You know, I was not the trial counsel, but there are some important nuggets contained within the exhibits of the critical age, particularly that the youngest child was at, that were incredibly important for purposes of promoting the parent and child relationship. 7 visits over that period of time.
Ask you about that period of time, and then I'll go to Judge Larkin. I see she has a question. I understand it, and I'm sure you know the record better than I do, that there was some initial period of time where your client wasn't cooperating, or there was it with, you know, getting a case plan in place. I mean, so when we're, I just want to define that period of time with these 7 visits as clearly as possible. So from your perspective, I mean, was it when she signed the case plan? You know, when did that start? Because I'm not sure it was February.
So I guess my response to that would be, there's several times that I think are somewhat critical in this case. So August 2020, when JKT entered Welcome Manor, and that period, certainly from August to December, I think it's critical. There were no in-person visits. There were two Zoom calls. That's it. There is no dispute in the record from the testimony of witnesses that JKT made progress during that time. So refusing to facilitate visitation during that time is problematic. Let's go back in time now from the February to August. Certainly the record contains information with regard to some of the concerns that were taking place during those visits. But again, I think a theme that really is borne out when reviewing the record before this court is how few these visits were, and looking at the totality of circumstances, how the complete lack of visitation created the circumstances that gave rise to February 2021. So, you know, certainly when the court made that finding in February 2021, I certainly would acknowledge there was an attachment assessment, a parenting assessment, and I believe the youngest child's therapist that said, hey, visits really may not be appropriate. It's creating issues with the child. But again, we need to look at the context with how we got there, because the county must prove by clear and convincing evidence that it made reasonable efforts, and visitation plans are clearly one of those things. And so when we look at that context and what led to that finding, and to go a step further, I recognize this is non-precedential case law, isn't a whole lot of case law that I can find that is precedential on this issue of visitation plans. But JKT was making significant ongoing progress on her case plan during that time. Certainly, it's hard to understand why there wouldn't have been a modification to that order. Judge Larkin?
Did JKT ask the district court to change the visitation schedule or the visitation restrictions once she started to comply with her case plan and was in treatment doing well?
Judge Larkin, I will need to review the orders that were offered as exhibits, I think, to answer that question. I do not know off the top of my head. What I can say, though, is that JKT was present at all of those hearings, had asked her caseworker to remain informed as to medical information. These children did have some rather extensive needs. But on the issue of visitation, I can't answer that. But the final point I want to make in regard to that is, certainly, could JKT have made that request? Sure. But JKT doesn't have the burden here. The county has the burden of proving clear and convincing evidence that its efforts from start to finish in this case were reasonable. And it appears, based on the record before this court, that the county effectively threw up its hands, really is what I would say, once the TPR petition was filed. When we look at the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law for this TPR order, they're focused almost exclusively on circumstances that predated the filing of the CHIPS petition, that predated mother's admission, and that predated the filing of the TPR petition, I believe in January 2021. Almost 5 months passed between the filing of the TPR petition and the TPR trial. And the law is clear. The county was required to continue making reasonable efforts to reunify. I see my time is quickly expiring. Judge Larkin.
I have a question. I think, and I don't have a citation in front of me, that there is case law that says a person can't complain that efforts were unreasonable if the person didn't object along the way and ask for additional services and raise the issue with the court. And that does make some sense to me, because, I mean, you're essentially asking us to fault the district court or the county in a circumstance, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the case here, but if there's a circumstance where, yes, the parent's in communication, yes, the parent's going to court hearings, but the parent has not done well at visits, there are professional recommendations that visits may not be in the child's best interest, and the parent's not really fighting that. I mean, is the district court wrong for thinking, well, mother's not objecting to this visitation schedule, this is the best thing to do for the child right now while mother works on her other issues? So I'm a little concerned about turning that around and saying, you know, this comes down to a burden of proof issue, and it doesn't matter what mother was or wasn't doing to foster that situation.
Judge Larkin, I just need one moment. I'm going to respond to that in more detail. I know I have a case on point I want to direct your attention to, but here's what I'll say. Again, I'm not saying mother was prohibited from making those requests, but when we look at kind of the bigger issue with regard to the actual services that were provided by the county, the findings that the court made rested largely upon mother not demonstrating the ability to meet her children's medical needs, as well as these concerns with regard to physical abuse. There were no services offered to address the latter. In fact, that largely came out at the trial through the children's testimony, those concerns. And finally, Judge Jessen, may I just finish my sentence?
You can have a couple of sentences to wrap up here.
Thank you. I just lost my train of thought. I'm going to get it back. There we go. When we look at the conditions that the court expected mother to correct, it was demonstrating the ability to meet her children's medical needs. How is she going to be able to do that when she's not allowed to have contact with them? She doesn't have visitation with them. She is not informed of their appointments. That is what makes the provision of reasonable efforts in this case unreasonable. I'm going to try to find the visits request, Judge Larkin, as well as that case that I think might be on point to answer your question. Until then, I will put myself on mute.
Thank you. Counsel respondent, we'll turn to you.
May it please the court. My name is Robert Whips, and I represent the respondent, Le Sueur County DHS, who was the petitioner of the TPR. In regards to this case, I know it's the county's position that the district court did not clearly err. And in fact, I think its findings were well supported by the record. As it relates to it finding four different bases to terminate mother's rights, I think it's important to keep in mind that to be upheld on appeal, only one of these bases would need to be found. The district court had made four different determinations. Yes, Judge Larkin.
I have two questions. One has to do with the facts. Am I correct in understanding that mother's newborn baby is with her or was with her in the treatment facility at the time of the proceedings and is not subject to this proceeding? Is that child subject to any other proceeding, child protection proceeding?
It's not in the record, Your Honor, but to my knowledge, yes.
Okay. And then what do you think the district court's strongest ground for terminating was in this case? I note that there appear to be some questions about the sufficiency of the findings given the legal requirements that are necessary to show egregious harm.
Your Honor, I think that the strongest basis would be basis number four related to the egregious harm. I think the record is clear that these children were subject to physical abuse, and the court made findings that they were subject to physical abuse, repeated physical abuse, as well as repeated neglect. And the court more specifically found that abuse and neglect is what was causing largely these children's mental health issues and developmental issues. Yes, Judge Justin.
If I may, by focusing on that statutory ground though, don't we walk right back into the concern that Ms. Stoll was raising, which is there didn't appear to be, you know, programming offered to or assistance offered to mother about her physical discipline or in efforts to address that. I mean, and I understand perhaps because it came out more at trial, but could you address that concern for me?
Sure, I can address that concern. I question how we can treat somebody for physical abuse and neglect, that repeatedly, after a year and a half of services, denies that they ever physically abused or neglected their children. What services can you offer to the person that just says, I never did that, that never happened? The only instance in which the appellant acknowledged that she inflicted trauma was on the day of trial, which by all means is too late. That's last ditch efforts to finally acknowledge that you've inflicted some trauma on your children. And the only thing she acknowledged is that it was related to her use, that her use may have impacted her children. And what you touched on earlier, as far as the first kid or the latest child that wasn't a subject to this proceeding, they're just not similarly situated in my mind. Mom's gone to prison twice for the older two children. She's physically abused them. She's sold drugs and exposed them to criminal activity in the home. They've been exposed to domestic abuse in their home. They have significant medical issues, delays, including physical medical issues. The oldest son has scarring of his lower intestines from his GERD being untreated while in mother's care. The youngest child has significant developmental delays. We're talking about in multiple categories. He's in the bottom 3% of development for a child of his age. The court found specifically, and the doctor testified, that much of that was related to mom's in utero exposure of drugs. And so when we look at the significant needs of these children, I think it also touches on the court's finding that mom wasn't in a position to presently care for them. I don't know how she can presently care when she doesn't acknowledge that her own children have these issues at the top up until the date of the trial.
Mr. Whips, if we may, can I go back, take you back to the visitation issue? Could you address the visit, you know, what visitation specifically for the, I believe, two-year-old, maybe three-year-old at that point, what visitation was offered between August 20th and December, which, so before the court's February 4th, 2021 order. I mean, I think that is the period, as Ms. Stoll said, when mother was at Wilkin Manor. Because I do think that's, you know, a very fair question, you know, given just the age of the child.
Your Honor, I have no reason to doubt that Ms. Stoll's representation as far as visitations during that period of time is likely accurate. I think what the court will find if it looks at the orders is that visitation was largely left to the discretion of DHS and the guardian ad litem during that period of time. And previous to that, there was significant issues with mother's visitations that the court touched on as well. So a lot of the reasons I think that the visits went down were because of mom's own actions. There's allegations that, well, she wasn't changing the baby's diapers, even with a parenting supervisor there and reminder. She disregarded medical orders and fed the child solid foods after she had been told explicitly that child could not have that type of food and it presented a choking hazard because of his tongue dysplasia and swallowing issues. When they had that visit at the facility, she continued to talk about the case with the children. She was asked to leave. She threatened that someone was going to die. Law enforcement had to be called. And all of these actions are taking place in front of the children. So the court and DHS dialed back the visits. And I believe that in the record, you'll also find that some of the visits, the difficulties I think experienced by DHS as a more rural county is that sometimes there were parenting time supervisors that weren't available. This was the period of during COVID, of course, which I think does have to come into play as far as the reasonableness of having in-person visits, because they did require a supervisor. And my understanding as well would be that those visits were largely by Zoom while mother was in Wilkin Manor. She also, while in Wilkin Manor, was approximately 2 to 3 hours, I believe, is the location of the facility from where the children were as well.
So just to be clear factually, the particularly problematic supervised visits that you referred to in your brief, where she's not changing the baby's diaper, or probably changing the baby's diapers, trying to feed baby solid food, having law enforcement called, those really occurred before she entered Wilkin Manor. I just want to make sure I've got the chronology right here.
Yes, I believe that is accurate, Your Honor. And I also believe that, so when we're talking about that August to December period, I believe that there was opinions that were written by both. She had the parental capacity evaluation done at that time, as well as the child's therapist. And the trial court was the one that made the decision to cease the visits, and it based it on those reports, as well as the child's therapist input as it relates to child three, the youngest child. And they found that the child was exhibiting a trauma response. He was experiencing mental health and behavioral declines after visits. They felt that these visits were re-traumatizing him, and he did not have the skills to cope with that. And that was displayed through him, you know, screaming, crying after visits, all of those type of things as well.
Mr. Ripps, if I could get back to something that Judge Larkin was asking about during appellant's argument. You know, with child protection cases, these types of cases, the district court is sort of managing the case as it unfolds, right? There are these interim decisions. And to the extent that somebody is challenging the reasonableness of efforts during the interim, or challenging the reasonableness of the visitation restrictions, that sort of thing, that's happening as the case is being presided over, that's a separate decision than at the end of the case, after trial, when the district court's trying to decide, has there been reasonable efforts? So the question I have is, stepping back from the facts of this case, just as a legal matter, if there were a period of time, say a 3-month period or a 6-month period, where the state might concede, or the agency would concede, that there were not reasonable efforts during that period of time, but throughout the entirety of the case, at the time it gets to trial, they're still arguing for reasonable efforts. Does our review of the reasonable efforts determination post-trial require reasonable efforts at every stage, or is it one overarching look back? In other words, are we reviewing that ultimate determination, or are we also reviewing all of those interim determinations of reasonable efforts along the way, the reasonableness of the district court's management of this case along the way as well?
I believe that the court is making a decision on reviewing what the district court found at the time, which is a review of the whole period that it found over the entire period that DHS had made reasonable efforts. And I think to support that along the way, as I referenced in my brief, there were a number of times throughout this case at these different review hearings where the district court continued to find that DHS was making reasonable efforts in its orders. And so to Ms. Stoll's piece of, even if mother had raised those issues at the different review hearings, as far as wanting more visitation, and to be clear, I also was not the attorney that was handling the ongoing management of this case. But to be clear, even if those things were requested, the court each time found that DHS was making reasonable efforts in regards to
that. What if the court's wrong at one of those periods of time, at one of those review hearings, the court makes a finding of reasonable efforts, but there actually weren't any. And now we are at the end reviewing this determination post-trial. Is it, if the state were to concede that this review hearing, that determination was incorrect, it was wrong, it wasn't reasonable, it wasn't well-founded, would we still be able to affirm the ultimate determination of reasonable efforts?
Yes, I believe you would be able to. The way that an interim finding along the way affects it is it does connect to some funding issues for DHS. And I believe that's what's imposed if there is a finding along the way. But I believe that this court is reviewing the entirety of the file and what the district court is determining when it makes that finding that they made reasonable efforts is it's reviewing the entirety of the case from the time of removal. And so logically to me, this court would also be reviewing the entirety. If there's one single instance where there was not reasonable efforts made, this court can still affirm that overall reasonable efforts were made along the way.
So whether we're calling it forfeiture or waiver or failure to object, you still think that we're taking this overarching look, right?
I do believe that.
So what is the remedy for a parent at the review hearing who thinks that the district court got it wrong, who hasn't had sufficient visitation, or the restrictions are, they disagree with the restrictions. What's the remedy at that point in time? Because you'd also agree, I'm assuming, that by the time it gets to trial, each of those interim decisions is setting the table or interwoven with kind of what the district court ultimately would look at in terms of what opportunities were given and what services might have or might not have been taken advantage of. So they are connected in a way. So the question is, what's the remedy for somebody at that time if they disagree with the interim management of a case?
So if they disagree with the interim management of the case at the district court level, we're required to file a court report ahead of time. Parents are also allowed to file a court report if they wish, or at the time of each hearing, they have the ability to object to what we have laid out in our court report. Now, if after that, the court makes a decision that they don't support, I suppose the remedy is then to motion for amended findings related to that hearing and ask the court, provide the court with what information they believed was incorrect and see if the court will decide differently. And that's the only remedy that I can think
about. Appeal. Is there any interim interlocutory appeal available or discretionary petitions or?
My understanding is that absent the underlying CHIPS adjudication, that can be appealed. But in between that and a final permanency hearing, I am unaware of an issue that can be appealed directly to a court of appeals. That's what I think we're ultimately left with. I see my time is dwindling down here. Again, I think if this court looks at the record, that the court's findings are supported by the record, I think ultimately the court did not clearly err because of that. And so I would ask this court to affirm the district court's decision, and I'll yield my last 5 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Whips. Ms. Stoll, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Larkin, I did review the court orders. I will admit it's not clear whether Mother objected to the ongoing suspension of her parenting time. The orders are pretty vague, so I simply can't answer that question based on the record that I found. I also said I was going to find you a case citation. I will acknowledge this is a non-precedential decision, but as I said before, with regard to visitation, the only two cases I've ever been able to find are the MAG case, which is 2018 Westlaw 591-5969, as well as In Re ECS 2019 Westlaw 226-2324. Within the MAG case, Judge Larkin, the court determined stated at page 7 that it is not MAG's burden to prove that she can meet JDG's needs. Rather, it is the county's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that even with the county's provision of reasonable efforts, MAG could not correct the conditions that led to out-of-home placement. I acknowledge that is slightly different than the point you were trying to make, but that was the one that had come to mind for me. Judge Bryan, I want to address this reasonable efforts piece. So reasonable efforts need to be reviewed at every stage of the proceedings. And when we look at reasonable efforts, let's take Mr. Whip's example of, your example, maybe there's a period of time it wasn't reasonable, but there's a reasonable finding later. The reason you need to look at the full picture is, when were those efforts unreasonable, and was it a critical stage where providing genuine assistance and providing reasonable efforts could have aided in reunification? And I think when we look at particularly the point from Mother entering Welcome Manor to the date of trial, there were not reasonable efforts made to reunify this family at the earliest possible time as required by statute. I think further, when we look at, it's kind of interplayed, the reasonable efforts and some of the statutory grounds alleged in the petition, they relate to Mother's ability to parent. What is so unique about this case is that she is successfully, based on this record, parenting her infant child full time without removal. We look at the record, and this is cited in my brief. There was actually, from my perspective, a sabotage of reunification, wherein the ongoing caseworker sent an email to Ms. McMahon that she acknowledged during her testimony that her goal of this assessment was to, quote, use this info together to sign consent together to adopt on the three older and not touch the new baby. Was that service and that intent truly meant to reunify the family, or was it to potentially try to put that final nail in the coffin to succeed with a termination of parental rights? When we look at that very unique circumstance of a parent demonstrating the ability to meet one of her child's basic needs who's in her care full time, I think that just overwhelmingly demonstrates that had she been given the opportunity in this case, she could have demonstrated her ability to parent. We can't infer an ongoing inability to parent based on speculation. We need to look at the circumstances as of the time of trial. When we look at the court's 20 plus page order, it is largely based on circumstances that predated her admission into Welcome Manor. And if that's what we're looking at, the circumstances as of the time of trial, how is any parent who finds their way into the child protection system going to be able to defeat a TPR petition?
But Ms. Dole, doesn't that, you know, aren't you ignoring the fact that she didn't have housing for all three children at the time of trial? She didn't have a job and where she was able to provide for them. I mean, I think I'll give you the opportunity to respond. It takes a little more time. But kind of the gloss that, oh no, this mother was in compliance with her case plan, I question that.
Your Honor, I will first note that in my statement of facts, there are citations to the record where the county conceded that she was very substantially in compliance with her case plan. I will turn next to the concerns you just raised. With regard to housing, again, let's look at the circumstances as of the time of trial. She had housing that was available for herself, for her youngest child subject to the TPR petition, as well as her second oldest child. I will concede the record shows she did not have appropriate housing for that oldest child, but she did have housing. And the record shows that for the next 2 years, that housing was available to her. I don't say that to set aside the oldest child, but we do have three individual children here whose needs and best interests may potentially warrant different results. And I think when we look at the two oldest children's preferences, that bears that out. You also mentioned, Your Honor, the fact that she was not employed. It was included as part of her March 2021 updated case plan. But again, other than the fact she didn't have a job, what evidence did the county submit to show she did not have the ability to meet her children's basic needs, despite the fact she did not have a job? That's the critical inquiry. You know, again, this is my final sentence, Judge Jessen. Just as we don't look at whether the parent is checking off the boxes, we can't apply that same in the inverse and say, failure to complete a box automatically means you can't reunify. And so I will conclude, Judge Jessen, by simply requesting that the court reverse the determination of the district court and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Further questions? Any other questions from the panel? Well, the court thanks you for the helpful arguments and briefing. The matter is taken under advisement and an opinion will be issued within our required time period. Thank you both.
Thank you.